acoustics and hearing quite strongly, your typical bird hears about half as well as we do.
Birds rely on their hearing to sense predators and prey and for mating. They need to hear each other's songs and calls in order to communicate and find each other. That makes them very sensitive to noise pollution. Clinton says some species, like the black-headed grosbeak, will just avoid places that get too loud for them.
In our long-term study sites in New Mexico, where we've studied how noise from essentially the energy sector restructures bird communities, we see a complete loss of about one-third of species in noise-polluted areas.
But Clinton says there are lots of ways to help, from switching to quieter electric vehicles to using lawn equipment outside of morning hours when birds are singing the most. Rakes are strongly encouraged. Or just leave the leaves. Learn more about what you can do to reduce noise pollution on the Bring Birds Back podcast. Listen in your favorite podcast app or at birdnote.org. I'm Tasha Lawson.
Hi, everyone. My name is Fahima Jalili. I am the host of Free Voices every Thursday from 3 to 4 p.m. Listeners, you mean a lot to us. Simply, I just want to thank you all.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM. We stream on the internet at cjsf.ca.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and today I am joined by Hale. Today we are going to be discussing a short chapter. It's actually the concluding chapter from a small set of essays written by the Canadian author Michael Ignatieff. So Michael Ignatieff is actually, well, he was, I suppose, but he was the leader of the Canadian, or leader of the Liberal Party, and also leader of the opposition from 2008 until 2011. So it's actually kind of interesting that now of all times we're reading someone who has been involved with the Liberal Party, considering the Liberal Party's recent win in their federal election. The book title is called The Needs of Strangers, and it discusses, like, essentially the book discusses the situation that humans are in political situations, and that is that humans have needs. Humans enter into political situations because they have needs. If they didn't have needs, they wouldn't need each other. Now, this is the concluding chapter where Ignatieff is kind of bringing together many of the meditations that happen throughout the text, but they sum up the main themes that are going on throughout most of the essays. I think one of the most interesting, and in terms of, there's many things that are interesting and sort of illuminating about this last conclusion, but even the initial point about needs is, it's not so much a departure from how we typically think of needs, but it is a point worth making, and that is that Ignatieff highlights that needs are historical, right? So he says, it seems a fact of life that individuals have different needs. That's sure, that's obvious, but some people need religious consolation while others do not. Some need citizenship, etc. Who is to say which is the truer path of human fulfillment? If human nature is historical, humans have different histories and therefore different needs. So he's not just saying that because humans differ, they have different needs. Humanity itself changes over time, right? We are historical beings. We have essentially, as he says, since the disestablishment of the churches and the granting of rights of toleration, some of our most durable historical needs for consolation and ultimate explanation have passed into the domain of private choice. Likewise, a market society leaves it up to each of us to find work capable of satisfying our needs for purpose and meaning. So our needs have changed over time, right? And what's interesting is that specifically because Ignatieff is talking about the political situation of needs, these needs are not just subject to historical change, but they are subject to political circumstances, right? So, and their satisfaction is subject to the change of history as well, right? And so, whereas before we had traditional institutions for satisfying particular needs in what he's calling in liberalism, we have resorted to the market to satisfy these needs, right?
So far, you're illustrating the general vibe, for lack of a better way of saying it, of Ignatieff's paper, and I found it quite interesting. But at least like with the concept of needs, basically, you know, Ignatieff, like obviously, like you said, he's a Canadian politician. He's the Liberal Party, like very involved in kind of like democratic liberal politics, in a way making a little bit of a case for saying, like, you know, the merits of our modern liberal democracies as we've seen it or experienced it. And he does, as you already said, like, and he illustrates that is a changing and evolving thing, like, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but it's that, like, there's a balance that can be had there between individuals living needs that are like private, like basically a private life, while also like being able to cooperate on a state level so that basic needs can be met, so that people can be free. Like, he kind of takes a couple times in the paper, there's almost like, you read between the lines of a jab and say something like, kind of like, pretty like intense or extreme libertarianism, where it's like, yeah, sure, like in theory, like that's the kind of like libertarian society when we're like, everyone can more or less do what they want. Like the bar for what is a harm that would involve state, you know, response or structuring in some kind of way is very, very low. But the reality is, in a society like that, as Ignatieff points out, it's like most people would never get the opportunity in that kind of society to actually actualize the needs that are their own private desires, wants, dreams, self-understandings, right? All this kind of stuff. And so by having a certain degree of like welfare, social institutions, organizations, you know, you can set up a society where people can much more realistically achieve those things. Like, basically, if you're poor as dirt, like your dreams aren't going to come true. Like, your needs become extremely like base, right? And those kind of look the same for everyone. I think a lot more is a little bit of, again, the subtext. It's like those base needs of like shelter, food, structure of some degree, pretty much all the same. But then there's this whole more like private needs orientation where it's like, are you going to be a sporty person? Are you going to be family oriented? Are you going to be chasing money or like, are someone, you know, committed to civic duty? And those are the things where he's like, we need to have society as free as possible to achieve that.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'm glad that you introduced this distinction between a public and a private kind of matter or interest, a public or private need. That's essentially, or for Ignatieff, liberalism is predicated upon that distinction, right? If you don't have your own private interest, well, your private interests have to have a relationship with public interests as well, because public interests, in an important but subtle and hotly debated way, enable you to enlarge your private interests. It's interesting you bring up the idea of libertarianism, considering that libertarianism's idea is that everyone is free to pursue their own private interests and whatnot. But I think rightly Ignatieff is picking up on this idea that, well, if you really take that to its extreme, or you play that tape to the end, people's interests, people's private interests, practically speaking, tend to reduce down to what we would call, you know, bare necessities or something like that, just satisfying yourself.
Well, and or you get like a more, I think like what you know, it's been brought up, especially as we talk 2025 with, you know, current, you know, it's always interesting to read a piece like this because it's very prescient with current political stuff, even though it obviously wasn't written this year. What year was this written? I was kind of wondering.
This is actually 1985.
Yeah, I had a feeling this was a little while ago. But it was still an interesting read. But what was the word I'm looking for? There's there's a certain type of libertarian. It's like a economic libertarian, but someone who's like, you know, super pro big business, super pro being able to get rich and independent. You know what I'm talking, listeners, I'm sure would be kind of familiar. This sort of like, you know, the primary thing that, like, the only really metric of success in society is being able to, you know, play the societal game, whatever that is, the most effectively, right? The most efficiently. And, you know, and that usually translates into, you know, being ultra wealthy is the kind of expression of being able to do that. And that, like, government and the state and any kind of like collective are just organizations to impede that process. Very like Ayn Rand-esque, you know, a kind of worldview, which obviously Ignatieff is very much in opposition to. Like, there's clearly, he makes it a point time and time again, there's clearly a need for base levels of structuring and welfare, which to me, reading these sections, those sections of the paper, really reminded me, obviously, of someone like Rawls, and like a more Rawlsian perspective, you know, going behind the veil, looking and thinking, okay, like, obviously, if we're a bunch of nondescript individuals about to enter some sort of civic society or civic agreement, like, obviously, you would think people want to be able to be successful, have their own freedom, but also, too, like, given their circumstances, have some sort of, like, assurance that, you know, if things don't work out for them or their place in, you know, starting off in, you know, really difficult conditions, that there will be some sort of safety net that will kind of lift them up or help a little bit, at least a little bit, to try and even the playing field. But that doesn't happen naturally in a free society, in a society of competition. But there's still, you know, there was a couple lines that I really liked. And one thing that he, and I'm sure we'll get in, because there's some other interesting stuff, but one thing he said in regards to freedom, he said, we have Augustine's freedom to choose. And because we do, we cannot have the second freedom, the certainty of having chosen rightly. I think reading behind between the lines, or more explicitly, but with that line, and then he says their resolution of alienation between self and society was a leap out of politics into metaphysics. That's talking about more highly structured or authoritarian societies. The point of the line bringing up there, right up there, is there is this tension within this kind of perspective where it's like, look, we can have a free society. We can even try and like hedge our bets on that free society by making it a some level of a welfare state where, like, we, as you said, like, we split public and private needs. We kind of say, okay, general populace needs to be able to feel safe, but most importantly, like, individuals have the liberty to pursue life as they choose. But that does still leave quite a bit of space for people to fail, right? For a chance for things to fall apart, especially on a private level, right? Like, now the opposite to that, like, as you said in that quote there, like, you don't have the freedom to choose rightly, to have a certainty to choose rightly. The opposition to that is obviously in an authoritarian state or a tightly controlled state where, you know, I think it's debatable if you're actually choosing rightly, but when everything is chosen for you and when the system pervades every aspect of your life or much more aspects of your life, then you're sort of stripped of both that freedom, but also that burden and responsibility of having to choose, right? Because the state gets to choose for you, society gets to choose for you. It doesn't even necessarily have, now that I think about it, like, it's an interesting point because it doesn't necessarily have to be an authoritarian society. Like, I immediately think of, like, very strict hierarchical societies, like, say, something like Ming China, or even, you know, periods within the context of something like the Roman Empire, where you do not have a lot of social flexibility. Like, you are born into a particular role, you're born into a particular societal caste, and your ability to transfer out of that position and make decisions that would sort of elicit or elucidate some sort of level of freedom or independence from society at large is just not really like a thing in the same way. And I guess within the context of modern society, again, coming back to like, you know, hyper authoritarian or totalitarian states, where that is very much expressly like suppressed, the private needs are seen as effectively threatening to the system, and everything is a public need. Your needs are always public.
I think it's interesting that you take us to that point, because as soon as I read that, there's a certain kind of, not self-refutation, but this what makes this an essay really interesting, is that since needs are historical, since needs change, the need for certainty, this need for a second freedom, as Ignatieff is calling it, that itself is historical, right? And when I think about what it would look like to not need that second freedom, to know that I really chose rightly, I'm thinking of maybe that is what kind of need was being thought into existence by, say, you know, the existentialists and all kinds of romantic movements, where we get to choose for ourselves, but we sort of disburden ourselves of that need to know, oh, did I choose correctly or not?
At the end of the day, the base distinction of the paper is pretty simple. Public, private needs, you know, there's a balance to be had. We try, through like the modern liberal democratic welfare state, we try and kind of balance that as much as possible. Some societies lean more one way, some societies lean more the other. But we're trying to have recognition of the individual as a free choosing being, but also one who participates in and is part of like a society writ large, and that the needs, wants, structures are all kind of historical, like a growing narrative. But part of that narrative, he kind of illustrates, is like this, the kind of language of theory, the language of understanding what those needs and how to get them, and that whole sort of setup, as ambiguous as it can be, looks within the context of any particular like societal epoch, any particular age or place or whatever, right? And he says, which I think is really interesting, and I think he was kind of, like, people who were thinking this way were kind of prescient for their own time, because as you said, he wrote this in the 80s, but like already, you know, obviously we've talked about many times, the 20th century and 21st century, especially the latter half and 21st century, have been an era of rapid societal change overall, right? And, it, you know, he says at one point, our political images of civic belonging remain haunted by the classical polis, by Athens, Rome, and Florence. Which, reading that, I thought that was a really interesting point, because I've never personally encountered that criticism before, like just so directly, where it's like, yeah, like we talk about civic duty, we talk about like the structure of society, we talk about, okay, like what is like the political, you know, horizon of, you know, of modern democratic society where we live in, and we kind of always go back to this democratic dream or vision of the polis, right? And I think he's saying that vision, that language, that description is pretty antiquated. I mean, it might have even been always a little bit fantastical, but it's really far removed from how we actually...
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think you're right in an important sense. I mean, I think about my reading of Hannah Arendt's book, her first second philosophical work, The Human Condition, where she calls back to the structure, the political structure, the polis, as allowing genuine action to occur, sort of unforced action where people rise up, they decide to act, and they get people who follow them, and it's unprompted. She's always been accused of polis nostalgia, in a sense, saying that, look, all of the stuff that we are doing, it takes issues with things. It wants to create movements. It wants to create revolutions. This is all great and this is all fine. But it all starts in the polis, where people, because of the free, because of their material freedoms and because of the distinction between a private and a public sector, the private being the home and the public being the polis, it's where you get to really show yourself. It's where you get to flourish. It's where you get to act as a human being. It's where not a what, but a who gets established, right?
Yeah, and I think that reading Ignatieff's work here, there's a certain degree of kind of, okay, when we are confronted by someone like Arendt and many other philosophers who have kind of advocated for this view or deconstructed our political lives in this kind of way, there becomes this question of, okay, like, where that, what you're talking about, like, where is that today, right? Like, that's the idealized version of this political life that, you know, to me, reading this, when I think about it, seems like something that I learn about in class, where we discuss, but is not how people actually operate within the context of social, like the social structure that determines the social needs and their balanced relationship with private lives, like today, right? Like, you know, Ignatius is kind of saying there's this general structure, like we talked about this whole time, the relationship to public politics or what public politics is within that structure is very, very different from the polis, where the citizen gathers around, and it's not even, you know, he has this interesting, speaking about the language, which I think can kind of be taken as a little bit, not just like literally the words, but also like the kind of the culture, the collective understanding of like what we're doing and what we're actually immersed in, like in a political sense. He says, language which has ceased to express felt needs is empty rhetoric. Right. And as I highlighted that, because it's like there's a certain degree to which, you know, thinking back to what we're talking about here, OK, well, if we're talking about the ideal political situation, we're reading Plato's, you know, we're reading The Republic. Right. We're reading, we're reading the Death of Socrates series. We're looking at, Aristotle's Politics, or we're reading even, you know, Hobbes or whoever. Right. All these primary modern democratic theorists of like one end or another, and yet like they seem very far removed, right? Like to what degree do their ideas become empty when faced with like how the challenges of modern, you know, political, like collective life? He goes on to say, they may cease to be felt. The generations that have grown up without ever hearing the language of religion may not feel the slightest glimmer of a religious need. So, like, you know, sometimes I think about, like, something like the concept of citizen, right? And obviously in the polis, at least when it's, as it's illustrated to us, or when we look back at it, we have this idea that this was a concept, a role, and a collective one that, like, at least the, obviously, like, ancient Greece was, like, a slave society and all this kind of stuff. So it's, like, we're talking about a specific set of, like, people living in Athens. But, you know, with the context of, like, that citizenry, that was, like, an important thing to have, right? To be able to be a citizen, to either, like, be born into that or through deeds or freedom, you know, being granted your freedom, whatever it's going to be, you know, being able to achieve that. And then, like, it's not just an empty title either, right? It's more than just a vote. It's basically an invitation or a duty to participate in a larger and consistent ongoing political process within the context of your city state, right? What does citizen mean to people today? Because it doesn't mean that, right?
Yeah, I mean, he specifically talks about he can already kind of anticipate a waning idea of nationalism and of the idea of being a citizen of a state or of a nation and moving towards something else, something more cosmopolitan, maybe a bit more global, but ecological in a sense. And it has to do with that changing need. For whatever reason, given the you know, economic and political circumstances, the state no longer supplies this felt need of belonging, and the idea of the earth and the idea of humanity is starting to emerge. And it's this that we are sort of planting our roots in, planting our feeling of belonging, our what he calls solidarity, fraternity. He says that it's interesting, right? He's able to account for his own difficulty grappling with it, because he says, again, these felt needs are expressed and maintained and live in language, and we have to keep revitalizing language and keep updating it for our time. We can't just look to the past and pull from metaphysics, essentially, right? We can't just pull castles from the sky that probably didn't even work in their own time, you know? We need language, and it needs to get... It's never going to be there in advance to express what we need. We have resources. We have the past to draw examples from. Like the word cosmopolitan was... I think it was actually... coined by Diogenes the Cynic. He said he was a... Mm-hmm.
I remember doing a paper. I remember reading quite an extensive paper on cosmopolitanism, but I don't remember anything more other than I read that paper.
Oh no!
But you know, I think it's really... I think you're generally right, and I think, you know, given when this paper was written, Ignatieff is looking... let's say it's the mid 80s. He's looking at a world. He's saying that, you know, the language that we're using for our political descriptions and understanding of, you know, our political life, you know, the we part rather than the I, where there's that balance again in like a modern democratic liberal society. He's looking towards a cosmopolitan world. He's looking towards a more globalist world and saying, hey, like, this is, you know, this is what's coming around the bend. This is what's happening, you know, like, the, you know, at the time, like the 80s, the Cold War seems like it might be winding down, which was... it's this new kind of like event horizon. It's new, you know, like Francis Fukuyama said, you know, it's like the end of history. Obviously, it was not. The interesting point is he talks about how quickly language changes or how quickly our concepts need to change. And I would say that we've already transferred through that period of cosmopolitanism, globalism, as that being the norm. And like basically like gone through that, and now we're stuck more in the language of that kind of world. What we're living in now is a turn that's been going on for the past decade to some kind of neo-nationalism type thing, right? Where we see, you know, greater and greater protectionism, the breaking down of like international, you know, free trade and economic ties. Rather to criticize this overall like theory, I will say that it's... he makes the point that the language changes, and I think he's right. I don't know if he knew how right he was about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, it's like it changes faster than he even realized. Like, mm-hmm, he's, yeah, like, I'm getting ahead of the ball here. We're talking about cosmopolitanism, globalism, and that's where we... and it's like, bro, like, your art, the second turn afterwards is already, like, not that far away.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? He gives this example of how pre-World War One, the peasantry, they might have heard the word citizen, but they would not have considered themselves a citizen of France or a citizen of Germany or anything like that. World War One sets in, they're mobilized, language starts to change, right? The reason that nationalism doesn't exist in the peasantry is because of regional dialects. They don't really communicate with each other. Once you have to communicate with each other, you gain a national sense through your language because now you're communicating. So it seems like he has a conception of the way that this language changes, where it can reach a kind of fixity, right? Now, he was so right that dissolved its own fixity, I think is what you're saying. We're no longer in an age where language can stay fixed at all. We only have change at this point.
Yeah, and obviously he talks about that within the context of modern society. There's just this rapidity of change. And, you know, to illustrate the point you were talking about earlier, because he talks about this, like we talked about Europe 1914 or pre-1914, like, you know, he makes a point, like the language shifts so much. And you can even see that literally in the dialects, like the language of the state was, you know, the main language, say like French or German or whatever, but individual principalities, even towns or villages, would have their own dialects that